This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Recently, at a Renegade University weekend event in Washington, D.C., we were joined by Camille Foster, the co-host of my favorite political podcast, The Fifth Column, and a partner at Freethink Media. In several public forums, Camille has been presenting a quite provocative and definitely radical set of arguments about race and criminal justice and their intersection in this country. What we like to do at Renegade University is take big and new and different ideas like that and put them to the test. And so that's what we did with Camille. We had him present the argument to us, and then we broke out into discussion sections. And the students or the members of Renegade University asked Camille questions, and they prepared questions that they then presented when we turned the microphones on in the podcast. This is Camille Foster at Renegade University in Washington, D.C. So I've said this in many public forums. Over the last 5 or 6 years, I have changed my position substantially on only one issue, which is crime and race. And I have changed it largely because of this guy, Camille Foster, who simply asked me a lot of questions about all of the feelings I was having in around 2014 and 2015 when everybody in the country was terribly upset about all the shootings of unarmed black people in the streets by police. I was one of them. I was really upset. I was crying all the time. I wanted to kill cops. I said that publicly. I was furious, just like so many other people during those years, right after Ferguson. And Camille, that's about the time when he and I started to talk about this. And he would sort of say, well, what, why? Are you sure? Are you sure it's a war against black people in the streets? And I would think, well, it sure looks like it. Look at the videos. And then I would realize that I had no other evidence. And then it's turned out that there's a whole lot of evidence out there that I didn't know about, unaware of, that he directed me to. And once I started to look at it, I had a very different idea about crime and race and the intersection between the two in this country. So I just want you to lay out your argument to all the people here and then have them come back at you or us with questions, comments, critiques. But I want you to just have the opportunity. Also, this is kind of a challenge to you. I don't know if I've ever heard you in a short period just lay out what your argument or position is on crime and race in the United States. So why don't you give it a shot and we'll see where we go.
Okay, well, I'm going to begin by disrupting the premise because my perspective, I don't have a unique theory about race and crime. I have a particular idea about race, how it divides us, obscures the truth, and generally ruins everything, which would be the subtitle to a book if I wrote one. And I apply my perspective on race to the issue of crime and social justice and criminal justice reform, which most people talk about with respect to race, because it illustrates that point really well. So, case in point, when people talk about police-involved shootings in this country, they generally talk about it with respect to race. They generally talk about the fact that blacks are killed in a proportion that seems pretty high relative to their share of the population. But if we take a holistic look at police-involved shootings, we know that on average, there's roughly 1,000 people who die every single year in the United States in a police-involved shooting. A small number of people die who are unarmed. It's not to say those are the only shootings that we should ever be concerned about not being completely on the up and up, but some percentage of them are unarmed. Something like 60 of the 1,000 are unarmed. It's a lot smaller than most of us probably suspected. And relatedly, something like 20 of those people who are unarmed and shot and killed by the police are black. About 30 are white. This changes the calculus pretty dramatically. Now, 20 of 60 is still like a decent number, and it's still going to look a little different than the 12% share of the population that black people make up. But when it's obvious that at least as many, if not more, relative to some value, white people are killed by the police, it totally changes the dynamic of the conversation. We stop speculating about whether or not the police are killing black people because they're super duper racist, whether or not the police are just out hunting black people down, and the universe of solutions that we're likely to try to bring to bear as we're looking to curtail the number of people who get shot and killed by the police, they're going to change too, because we're no longer distracted by the notion that racism is the fundamental thing that we should be concerned about here. And I could apply, again, the same instinct about the way race causes us, and race and presumptions about racism cause us to ask the wrong categories of question in a bunch of areas related to police and criminal justice reform. And I mean, you wrote an essay for Reason some time back, which concludes with an insight that I thought was very powerful, related to the fact that if we were actually to remove all of the black people, all of the minorities from prisons in the United States would still be among the world's leaders in incarcerating human beings, which again reframes the problem completely. Is mass incarceration, is the war on drugs, are these things fundamentally about race? Kinda. There is some element of that. Historically, we know that narcotics laws have had something to do with race, but it's a practical matter. In 2019, the fact is that the impact of these laws are broadly shared across all of society, and that undoing the harm that these laws are causing, even if they're disproportionate relative to their share of the population, requires race-neutral policy that is not caught up in all of this meandering and hand-wringing that we do about racism and racial bias on the part of the police. I think that those conversations generally take us further away from scoring reform, and they ignore the broad impact of bad policy related to policing and police-involved shootings and all the rest.
I think we're good.
That's it? We're done. It's a wrap.
I think that's a great summation of your argument. I'm a little surprised, I have to say. I thought, because you're often hesitant to be declarative, and that was really clear and declarative. So I think we've got it. I think we have something to work with, right? So let's break up into discussion sections and then come back and discuss this with Camille. So now we're ready. We've discussed this and we're back in the room and we're going to talk to Camille. So who would like to begin? Let's go, Nathan.
I'm going to steal Isaiah's question. And you said criminal justice reform, pro-cop or anti-cop? Because I don't see a reduction in violence unless we reduce the size of the force. I believe that it's a compliance system. It's for wealth extraction and for ensuring that you're a good citizen. You listen, like you do all of the acceptable things. So what does criminal justice reform look like? Are we abolishing cops entirely? Are cops necessary for the enforcement of laws? Do we still have courts after that if we don't have a force to threaten? Like, hey, you gonna show up to your court date?
So there's two ways to approach that question. One is very philosophical and speculative, me imagining a world where we've abolished police forces and states and all sorts of stuff. I'm not gonna go in that direction because, I mean, it's an interesting question, but for anyone listening, they might be a little more grounded in what we have currently. Police reform in a contemporary context where we do, in fact, have governments and there are laws that are broken and there is a goal of trying to ameliorate the harm that is caused to people when laws are broken. Let's say there are two goals that I have in mind. I want to limit the scope of things that we are prohibiting. don't want to prohibit things that don't involve injuring some other person. But if you are stealing, if you are injuring other people, I want you to be caught and I want you to be prosecuted in a way that is reasonable. What does reasonable mean? Debatable, right? When it comes to policing and police forces and the size of the police force and the amount of money that we give to the police force, I actually think, and I'm actively thinking about this now, I think that's those questions might be secondary to the mandate of the police force. It matters if the police have a broad mandate to bust heads for virtually any kind of infraction, or if the scope of what the police are interested in are enforcing natural rights. It matters if the clearance rate for murders in Chicago is below 20%, which it is. So if you tell me that you want to double the police force so that you can get the clearance rate to 100%, I'm not going to be thrilled about it if I got to pay twice as much. But you don't even have to pay twice as much to double the police force if that is your mandate. So I think we have to think about the problem in a different way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Reduce the number of prohibitions that you can have, and it reduces the amount of interactions the police have with the public, because in the instance of prostitution being legal or changing the age, like in the Netherlands that Maggie was talking about, it's like, oh, there's the underage sex panic is going crazy. It's like, well, you lowered the age of consent from 18, or you raised it from 16 to 18. So now there are a bunch of 16-year-old formerly legal sex workers, mm-hmm. and you moved the goalposts. So now there's a bunch of criminals because you made them criminals.
So Nathan, I think you're kind of questioning whether Camille's an anarchist. Because he identified himself as an anarchist, and he has done that publicly many times.
Guilty.
And now he's talking about putting people in prison.
Camille Foster is philosophically an anarcho-capitalist. From a practical standpoint, my politics are pragmatic. I am willing to endorse any policy that I think is likely to yield better outcome than the status quo, at least in a qualified way. I am generally opposed to public schools. I think it is a terrible way for us to go about trying to educate the next generation. I don't think they're innovative. I think they fail lots of kids. I think they worse than fail kids. They put kids' lives in danger. That said, I support charter schools. I support vouchers. I support school choice programs more broadly. And I fully oppose any attempt to standardize at the national level curriculums, because I think that would actually make things worse. And I think I would go so far as to say I think we have a bit of a moral obligation to be reasonable about our advocacy when it comes to like freedom and liberty for people who share my radical views. Like, if the knife is in someone's chest and you're unwilling to help this person by pulling it out a couple of inches, provided pulling it out is the right thing to do in the circumstance, because you can't pull it out all the way. I mean, that just seems crazy to me. Like, we can actually make things better. And the fact is that our improvements as a society, our improvements as a country, have been incremental. Like, we've made gains in a piecemeal way, as opposed to making gains by implementing some radical new departure from you know, previous bad policies. The abolition of slavery was something that happened over time in phases, and I would gladly move from slavery to Jim Crow. I would also gladly move from Jim Crow to something else. I'm not saying I advocate for Jim Crow, but again, like, with qualifications, one can endorse a policy and say we need to do better than this.
Rapid social change usually has a very high body count.
And that's another thing too. But my other thing is, let justice be done though the heavens fall, which I'm fine with that.
So in our group, we were talking about the possibility that simply the addition of police creates more casualties, more contact with civilians, and therefore more physical contact, more violent contact with civilians, and more deaths. We think that you just add more cops, you're going to get more death and more incarceration. So I think the anarchist position that Nathan is kind of looking for here, I think, is calling for the abolition of police. But there's a different way to go about it that would be the Camille anarchist practical position, maybe, which is to just continue, maybe, to reduce the number of police. Is that it? You're always for reducing the number of police?
The number of police is secondary to me to the mandate that the police have. Like, I want to restrict the mandate so that they're focused on things that are actually violations of natural rights, that actually involve people harming one another, rather than give them these broad, generalized mandates that allow them to endanger people's lives. There are bad things that someone will have to adjudicate. If I had my own way and I were recasting society, you know, would I create private security forces a la Friedman's Machinery of Freedom? Sure.
Okay.
But I don't have such abilities, and I don't know that I'll ever have that option. In the circumstances I currently have, I'll worry about the mandate of the police department first. I'll do everything I can to make certain there's accountability and transparency with respect to law enforcement. And I would like the police force to be commensurate in size to the challenge that they're facing.
You know, socialists have this argument all the time, right? They have for hundreds of years, reform versus revolution. It's this old argument. Do we go for reform or do we call for revolution? And socialists have been debating this forever and ever. And this is kind of the libertarian version of that, or the anarchist version of that, right? Which is, Nathan Wright, what do you say publicly? What do you support publicly? What is your position? What do you want for? You, Nathan, I think, you want a policeless society or a largely policeless society? Or?
No. I think I kind of agree with Camille. I don't trust an organization to reduce itself in size and to stay that way. Organizations justify themselves. So, I don't know. I guess maybe abolish the police?
But in the meantime, end the prohibitions, which will also end the number of police necessary to enforce them, right?
And maybe target the systems that allow the police forces to abuse the public trust. Like, they just now started targeting police unions, pension funds. That's obscene. That would have stopped everything, any kind of corruption immediately, because they don't have any fucking money.
Agreed. Bust that union. I'm all for it. It's my socialist coming out. You know, we were big union busters when we were socialists. No. Those are the two unions that I'd like to see busted immediately, the cops unions and the prison guards unions.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. Talk about monopolies that are harmful.
Yeah. Save the teachers union. Thad Russell.
Oh, no. Teachers union. I'm sorry. My bad. They get to go first, actually. Take it back. I hate them even more. Nathan, that was great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Everyone knows, I think, the world, and especially Americans, is overworked. And today, it can be very hard to find the time to sit down and learn more about the world. It's not easy when the likes of social media can be so addictive and time-consuming also. So you may think you don't have the time to read a whole book or to develop yourself. In fact, I often don't read a whole book. I usually just use it for my work. There's an app I highly recommend. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is the only app that takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, the kind I use, and condenses them down into just 15 minutes so you can read or listen to them easily. Blinkist is made of people like you and me, very busy people with active work schedules, who want to get the main points of the books very quickly without reading the entire book. With an audio feature, Blinkist makes it so easy to finish 4 books a day while you're on the go. 8 million people right now are using Blinkist, and it has a massive and growing library, from self-help to business to health to even history books. I like Blinkist personally because, as I said, for my own work, I use books rather than read them entirely. So in less than 15 minutes, I feel like I can get from a book exactly what I need. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for the unregistered audience. Go to Blinkist.com/renegade to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/renegade to start your free 7-day trial. Blinkist.com/renegade. Who's next? Who's up? Isaiah.
So, I am for abolishing the police, like, writ large. I think that, generally speaking, in my day-to-day life, I am pragmatic. However, with issues of authority and entrenched authority and how things exist in society. If we accept their legitimacy, then they become legitimized in our own minds. So by accepting the legitimacy of reform in our performance of our day-to-day lives, we're not really getting to the point that we ideologically support, you know, within our philosophical schemes. Alongside that, it's often, as Nathan was saying, once something becomes an institution or a structure, it tends to maintain itself. Do you think that still maintaining the scheme of criminal justice as a institution is useful for framing the conversation about policing and enforcement and violence and incarceration?
I think conversations about radical departures from the status quo can be enormously valuable. I think questioning the premises upon which our society has organized itself can be incredibly valuable. I also think it's enormously valuable to be pragmatic, because there are things that we could do instantly that would have zero social ramifications that are adverse. And there are things that we could do instantly that would probably have adverse consequences. And there are things that I could persuade you of that are radical. And there are things that if I were to try all day long, I'll never really get most people there. And I just don't think that in Detroit, in Chicago, in New York City, like, abolish the police is actually a very compelling argument. I don't think it will work for most people. I don't think they imagine that the legitimacy of the police is sort of the principal fundamental issue. And I think to make the argument in principle is fine, but I think as a practical matter, if all of us were pulled over by the police today, we'd pull over, they'd ask for license and registration, and we'd hand it to them. We might give them a little bit of shit. Sometimes that happens. But most of us wouldn't take the sovereign citizen route and say, I don't respect your authority. You don't have any right to pull me over. This is wrong. And by acknowledging you and giving you my ID, I am committing an egregious moral crime. I'm doing something to further instantiate this apparatus of control. I mean, maybe we should be resistors in that way. Maybe we should go, you know, full on like slave rebellion. But I just don't know that that's the most practical and effective way to go.
I would agree to that. And that's why I said in my day-to-day life, I'm pragmatic. If I get pulled over, I'm going to do what I can to leave that situation safely. But in the way that I talk about it, in the way that I present it rhetorically, I think to take that incremental approach in your rhetoric in situations such as this is detrimental to your overall goals. If you are stating that you want the state to either be overthrown or fade away.
I was going to get Socratic. I won't get Socratic now. Make some space with that.
So rhetoric. I love that. You introduced rhetoric.
Oh, that's what I was
rhetorical
ask
strategies,
about.
Yes. Right? Isaiah was questioning your rhetorical strategies.
Yes.
But I think he might have been going even deeper and maybe questioning your rhetorical objectives, your inner objectives. I think he might even be questioning again whether you're an anarchist.
Well, this is what I was going to ask about. What is the goal of your rhetoric?
Personally, I enjoy making people uncomfortable with the way that they think things are. So I'm somewhat of a contrarian, but the overall goal is to make people think about why they believe what they believe and question the culture in which we live, because through doing that, they can understand that we don't have to live this way if they don't like it, or they can continue to replicate it if they do like it.
My principal goal when I am publicly advocating for ideas is to persuade people above all else. I'll do it by making an appeal to our shared appreciation for the cuteness of babies or puppies or whatever it takes, but I want to persuade you. I want to persuade you towards my moral ends because I think it's better for society if we get there. Maybe making you uncomfortable is a way to get there. Perhaps making you uncomfortable is a way to alienate myself from everyone. But if the goal of rhetoric is persuasion versus the goal of rhetoric being making people uncomfortable, then I think from a strategic standpoint, like it perhaps might change the course that you select.
I would say that my thought of making people uncomfortable is not necessarily confrontational, although it certainly can be, but it's more flirtatious.
I get
I'm serious.
Yeah, no, and yes. And flirtation could sort of end with you going home by yourself, or it could end with you totally winning.
Yeah, exactly.
Not Isaiah.
So I always want to close.
So
ABC.
I mean, sometimes the goal is to not close for me. So I'm serious.
I get you.
Like, because sometimes it's just not worth it.
If it's not worth it, I'm not even going to bother flirting. Like, well, this, and
you
that,
know, sometimes
that,
somebody would be looking good, and then you go up and talk to them, and then they start talking, and you're like, no.
Yeah, that's when I bailed. Actually, this is a great point, because I have a lot of conversations with people where I realize this isn't going anywhere. This isn't going anywhere because you think I'm a monster. And I will highlight the fact that you think I'm a monster and that you know my perspectives better than I do. And you know what motivates me from a moral standpoint, and you refuse to accept anything else. I say thanks, but no thanks. And I leave the conversation. It's likely I can't do anything to sort of make progress here. My time is scarce and valuable. Can someone sort of make a comment in some instance that later takes root and eventually blossoms into a beautiful flower? Totally. But I think in a lot of contexts, we end up pounding away at walls and pounding away at objectives that are just unlikely to be successful. And again, that doesn't mean that we can't imagine a possible future that is far better than this future, that is a more moral and just future. Like, the abolitionists who plotted slave rebellions weren't wasting their time, right? Were they being pragmatic? Certainly not. They refused to live under those constraints. But I think it's absolutely essential to recognize the degree of difference between those extreme circumstances and the circumstances that we currently live under, which, most of the time, most of us live like pretty extraordinary lives of prosperity and opportunity and advantage relative to most people in human history. And if we begin with that fact in mind, and we want to improve things and make them better, then I think that the case for pragmatism is pretty strong.
And I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Because Martin Luther King needed Malcolm X. I think that both are very valuable.
Yeah, it's a great point.
I got nothing. I love this. Yeah. This is one of the best conversations I've ever heard. I got nothing to say. Thank you.
My work is done here.
Yeah. Let's go, James.
So I guess mine's not quite as much about criminal justice or cops.
Do what you want.
But it does kind of peripherally relate to the Black Lives Matter movement and sort of the anti-cop rhetoric that you hear. What do you think is the cause of the shift in sort of the cultural trends from, Jonathan Haidt has kind of popularized it, but I think it comes from a different source. Shifting from what they call a dignity culture, where John McWhorter says like when he is confronted by a racist slight, he sees the racist person as like gum on the bottom of his shoe. Whereas now, not only is that racist slight evil, which it always has been, but now it's sort of seen as a badge of honor to have been attacked. It's almost like a commodification of victimhood, Where do you think that comes from, and what do you think, short of like some cataclysmic event, would be a solution to it?
I don't know where it comes from. I actually hadn't heard John refer to encountering a racist as gum on the bottom of his shoe. That's great.
Yeah.
It does, I think, get at something that we talked about a little earlier in one of the two rooms. Just the low availability of actual racists in our world relative to the demand for racists. And if encountering real tangible racism, not that imagined racism when you go into the store and someone doesn't say hello to you, or they say hello to you and you're wondering if that is somehow racist, but that real, hey, I don't like you because you're black, and black people are always awful and they are congenitally defective. You know, the sort of thing you might hear if you're listening to like Stephen Molyneux or something. Shots fired. When you encounter genuine racism, to become like a hero, a champion of sorts, maybe it's because it's so rare and unusual in a tangible, active sense. But I don't know. I don't know. I certainly appreciate the distinction that's being drawn there. And I definitely think John has the right approach. I mean, the fact is that actual racists are regarded with extreme derision, and even imagined racists are regarded with extreme derision. I just don't know why we ought to pretend otherwise.
So John McWhorter said that when he was at Rutgers, I believe as an undergraduate, he encountered a few instances of clear racism, and he said that he considered those people to be like gum on the bottom of his shoe. Camille Foster, I don't think you've ever said to me, or publicly, maybe I'm wrong, that you've ever experienced anything like that kind of racism in your own life. Is this true?
I've had one instance of a white person saying to me, "nigger," in a way that was meant to express contempt. But even that was weird. It was a young girl. I was living in Ashburn, Virginia. It was a young girl who she came out of the house, and we had been playing. We'd been playmates. So she's a neighbor. And I said, "Hey, what's going on? You know, can we do the thing?" And she says, "Well, my daddy says I can't play with niggers." And she seemed confused. Mm. And I was confused. And I was like, "All right, well, I'll go inside." And I told my dad. And my dad talked to her dad. Mm. And this was never heard of again. And I had never really interacted with her again. That was it. That is the most obvious, explicit sort of racism I've ever encountered in my life. Most of the racism that I've encountered is essentialism, and most of it has come from black people. Mm. There have been a few white people brave enough to call me an Uncle Tom or a coon or something like that. But every other circumstance, I would just have to speculate. I can't know. I can't know if that time I got pulled over while being a passenger in an Uber, where the cops were sort of active in this particular area, if they pulled me over in that car to inspect things because they could tell I was black in the dark at night before they got to the vehicle. I could presume, and in presuming, create for myself a narrative of a world in which I have to always watch my back, or I could acknowledge the uncertainty and move on, because what does it cost me to be wrong in categorizing that as not a big deal? Nothing. Gum on my shoe.
There you go. What do you think, James?
I think I feel good. Thanks.
Yeah?
Okay. That's well, the goal.
Yeah. So what? No. Okay. So a follow-up, I guess, would be like, so you don't know the cause. You don't really know the solution. But what can we as individuals, I guess, do when dealing? Because right now, you know, you see a lot of the essentialism from other black people. But also, I mean, from right-wing white people, it's becoming more and more popular. I run in libertarian circles, mm-hmm. and libertarianism has always been like the inclusive, you know, anti-essentialism from what I can understand. I mean, maybe in certain circles, like the paleo libertarians or whatever, but that's becoming more and more popular.
Yeah, there's a lot of libertarian anti-racists and libertarian people who are woke. I don't know what you do about that except to just keep engaging with people on a factual basis and keep challenging them to live out the principles that we espouse. If we say we believe in equality, if we say what matters is the individual and not their phenotypic traits, then I think we have to conduct ourselves accordingly. It is entirely possible to have concern for people who have been harmed historically or otherwise without making race the fundamental quality of concern for us. And for me, I've always said racism isn't special. Like, it isn't special in the sense that I can find a great many ways in which to discriminate against you. And even if you want to talk about historical realities, like, most people throughout most of history have been subjugated and harmed in various ways. And when I think about how we make things better for people, it's hard for me to see how racially coded solutions actually get us to better outcomes. Like, generally, I see them creating social division. I see them making it harder for us to make progress on particular issues. I see it making it harder for us to discuss issues in an open and honest way. I see us having less graciousness with one another in private settings where just saying something in an inelegant fashion costs you your job, destroys friendships. That is what anti-racism yields. And I do think that their hearts are in the right place. But I think it's always relevant to ask yourself whether or not you are not concerned enough about something or whether you are too concerned about something. And there are seldom times when I see anti-racist people be willing to acknowledge the fact that they are over-concerned about race in a particular circumstance. And that has consequences.
So you're saying a good deal of empathy is in order?
Yeah,
on all sides.
If empathy is a thing, Thad.
I don't know. Do you want to talk about that? We can talk about empathy.
Yeah, talk about empathy.
I don't think it really exists. I don't think we can ever really know what's inside someone else's head. I think largely what we're doing, probably all of what we're doing when we think we're practicing or experiencing empathy, is projecting our own feelings and experiences and histories onto other people and things and other histories and other places.
Mm-hmm.
So on a college campus,
I don't disagree with that.
These days, and you know this very well, right? What does the woke left say all the time about any racist incident, alleged racist incident now? They always talk about what? Not the present. They always talk about history.
Mm-hmm.
They always talk about slavery, Jim Crow, da-da-da. It's always a reference to history. History will never die. They always live in the past. That's really where they live, because they will not ever cede that ground. They will never remove themselves from that victimhood status. And they had it in the narrative. Their victimhood status is perfect and pure in the textbook, in the historical narrative, as victims, because they, at least their ancestors, were pure victims in that narrative, right?
There's no one more beautiful than a pure victim. There's no one more beautiful, more wonderful, more virtuous than someone who's been destroyed for no fault of their own. Like, they're noble, and we can all reverence and revere them.
Like,
we all want a little bit of that power.
Kind of like Jesus.
But it also exists in living memory, though. It's not just the history books, right? I mean, there are people...
Who's living memory?
Well, people's grandparents, let's say.
Yeah. You mean Jim Crow?
Yeah.
Sure. Of course.
Yeah,
there are people absolutely who lived under Jim Crow.
And there are, I would say, many more people who imagine themselves a party to the worst suffering of slavery and who have no person who can attest to them with respect to what that was like. And I think that co-opting suffering in that way, imagining it as your own, is poisonous in a lot of different ways. I think, again, there's too much and there's too little. I think there is a point at which, when you imagine yourself, there's actually this great YouTube video of James Baldwin having a debate with firing line.
Buckley.
William F. Buckley, where he's giving this speech and he says, "I picked the cotton and I love James Baldwin. I have a deep affection for a lot of James Baldwin's work, and I'm skeptical and critical of other aspects of it. But no, James, you didn't. That wasn't you." And I do think it's imperative to draw a distinction between ourselves and our circumstances and our unique challenges and the challenges of people who came before me. And I don't think embodying the skin of past victims in that particular way, in that context, is necessarily always helpful.
You're not a big fan of race victimhood. You're also not a fan of race pride.
Nah.
It's the other side of
race,
that, right?
Race pride in me had to go.
Other side of that
Zora
coin.
Zora Neale Hurston. Yeah.
Talk about that. Race pride. What did Zora say about race pride?
I mean, I just gave you the most of that essay that I could excerpt, that I could quote. I can give you the rest of it. But the general sentiment is that accomplishments, achievements do not belong to particular classes of human. That Jews are not responsible for or a party to all of Einstein's accomplishments, and that blacks are not collectively responsible for or a party to all of Carver's accomplishments. It's a pity that she goes to Carver there.
George Washington Carver.
Fame of peanut fame. Not to ridicule the man, he's certainly smarter than me. But it's poisonous for precisely the same reason that it would be poisonous to imagine that the failing of any one black person is somehow mine, or that the failing of black people collectively is mine because we both happen to be black. It's a perverse way to go about living your life on both extremes.
Perverse and self-destructive.
Yes.
Right. And
broadly destructive to society. I don't think it's good for I don't think it's good for society to have that sort of collective treatment of accomplishments or collective regard for accomplishment. This is why I object to things like Black History Month.
It is funny. I've thought about this ever since you said that to me several years ago. You know, like, taking pride in what your ancestors did is really absurd. I had absolutely nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What they did before, bad or good, I had absolute, because I didn't exist. Guys, this is very basic, but you're right. It's so amazing. I nonetheless walked around until I met you, goddammit, thinking along those lines. You know, like, I have a good friend who's like one of the leading collectors of, he calls it African diaspora art, and it is. It's primarily African American art. His apartment is absolutely full of this incredible art. And it's all clearly very much an expression of race pride for him. And mm-hmm. he talks about it that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was with him on that because I love black culture, right? And I always have. And so when I'm in his apartment, to me, it's just like this incredible museum, and I totally support him for this. Mm-hmm. But when you came along, I was like, oh shit, now I got to tell my friend that.
Did you guys have the talk yet?
Not yet, but I will.
Yeah. Thad Russell
when
is
he's
the,
on
Rachel,
the, podcast.
The Rachel Dolezal of historians. I think it's true. You love blackness.
Oh,
you pretty much
right.
consider yourself a black man.
Well,
and this is the thing. And this is the thing. To the extent we're going to play that game, if we go back far enough, everyone has a black mom, right?
Oh yeah.
In which case, collect your African art. Collect it on behalf of blackness. There is no culture that we all have sort of any great claim to more so than blackness. That statement makes sense. You can check the math. It's true.
Check the lineage. Yeah. Check the gene pools, you mean.
All of that.
Yeah, we're all black. Amen. Except you.
We're all here's what I'm actually saying. We're all African.
Ooh, nice. Yeah. I like it. Actually, let's go one better. We're all just one.
Amen.
All right, there you go. James, do you buy it? Are you a Christian now?
Well, yeah, sure.
Holy Spirit.
I have been touched.
Thank you.
With your consent.
Naturally.
Josh, come on up.
I think maybe I'm going to make an invalid overgeneralization. I think by and large, many white people think of this policing problem as like, well,
it's a black problem.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
think about crime that way as well. Like, black people should be more concerned with the fact that their black child is likely to be shot by a black person, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So to me, it seems dangerous. We already have military hardware landing in the hands of domestic police forces. You know, like, do we want to run the risk of the chickens coming home to the roost, but, you know, this time the chicken is a Reaper drone? And, you know, that sounds a little far-fetched. Hopefully it always will be. So if policing is a black problem, but we're going to abolish race, is there a blind spot where we don't look at the abolishment of the white identity to some degree? Because they're co-constitutive identities.
Nice.
Yeah. That's really
so
good. Yeah.
If we're always stuck on thinking about black oppression, because, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the day, it's privilege is not Kevlar. So it's not going to stop a bullet. Do we deceive ourselves thinking that, you know, it is a black problem and I'm white? And do you think there's anything useful or productive in terms of looking at the white side of the equation, which seems to be less popular in this narrative in the media about, you know, policing and black oppression or in all these issues, and saying, you know, like, if the stick is being applied more harshly on one side, in what ways maybe is that meant to make the carrot all the more attractive to me? What ways is this supposed to manipulate my own perception and construct my identity? You know, because empathy can always only go so far. You know, white people are not going to have the black experience necessarily in America. So,
well, I mean, there's a presumption of a uniform experience there.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I know.
Can it elicit like some introspection and be like, what is this narrative doing to me? And so we can kind of dissolve these boundaries.
Well, let me try to put a different, slightly different frame on this, because I feel like you've said a number of different things that are related in important ways. First, I mean, my own position, I'm a race abolitionist. I'm not a black abolitionist. I think all race is stupid. I think race, generally speaking, often distracts us from being able to understand problems in a way that is useful. And when I say useful, I mean we can describe the problem in a meaningful way and articulate solutions that are likely to be successful. I think using the racial lens to try and understand something like police involved shooting, as I described earlier, is a mistake, because it's not obvious from the available data that black people are being uniquely targeted. The goal then isn't, like, you have many choices you could make after that. You could say, well, then let's look at this as a white issue. Let's see if whites are overrepresented, in which case maybe whites are being hunted by the police. Well, yeah, that's not it either. Well, maybe there's just a broad issue with policing, and what we really want is for the police to kill fewer people overall. Mm-hmm. And that's where I come out. And I think it's much more useful to talk about issues in that way. Now, the second related question there is, well, what if there is an issue that is related to race? And what if there is an issue of disparate experiences for black people that we don't pay attention to because we've disregarded this particular lens? It's possible. It's a possible thing that might happen. But since my alternative is to try to ferret out injustices that are happening writ large, like, it matters to me if they're happening overall. And I mean, might I lose track of it, like, in the global data? I suppose that's possible. But given all of the areas where we're actually looking, given the things that we're paying attention to, I just don't often see evidence of the particular concerns about race actually materializing. And I think that the over-concern about race, the various places where we imagine racial disparities existing and imagine ugly racist motives for police that don't really seem, and you hear the sirens coming for me right now, where we imagine ugly racist motives for police existing where they might not exist, I think that's actually worse. Mm-hmm. I think that's the problem that we probably have to worry about more than the possibility of overlooking some aspect of the black experience, especially in 2019. And in 2019, I think notions of black experience, like, it just seems absurd to me. Like, which black people are you interested in? The first generation Americans like me?
Yeah.
Because my experience is pretty fucking dope, honestly. Yeah. If I tell you truthfully, I can do a lot of the things that I want to do. I've been very successful in this country. Like, black women in this country get collegiate degrees, for better or worse, at a rate that exceeds pretty much
everyone
in the country.
I think Lil Wayne said something similar to what
you're saying. So what are we really talking about here? Do we want to imagine these people as injured? despite the fact that they're thriving? Because that sounds like what's being described, and that concerns me.
So, Camille, you are not willing to call for the abolition of police, but you're very willing to call for the abolition of prohibitions, and most provocatively, the abolition of race.
Yes.
You called yourself a race abolitionist.
Yes, I am.
That is hot.
Good.
Never heard that. I like that.
Oh, I thought I'm sure I've said it to you before. Yeah.
Okay. I guess I haven't heard
that. Different instincts.
Camille Foster, : race abolitionist.
Yes. Amen.
I like it.
Yeah. The John Brown of race.
Exactly.
Terrorist. Race terrorist. That's actually not true. That's not a bad week for that joke as well.
Yeah, seriously.
Don't
you've never brought terror to anyone. You've only brought love.
No.
Okay.
And I would never initiate force against
anyone. Don't you forget that.
Yeah.
Josh, you good?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
And thank everyone for this. This was great. Thank you so much. And the discussion sections, I kind of wish we had microphones in those rooms because we really were chopping it up in there and you guys did amazing work and I learned a lot from you guys. Thank you so much for all of this and I hope to see you again. Thanks very much.
This was the Unregistered Podcast and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To support the show and become a member of the Unregistered community, go to unregisteredunderground.com. Thanks for listening.